Monster Man, special episode, The Monsters of Bloodborne. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Zach. If you'd like to be like Zach and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get access to the rewards for all other tiers, including all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities. So Zach, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoy the show. Now, Zach has asked me to do something I'm not sure I've ever done before. I'm pretty sure I've done at least one video game monster episode before, but this is a video game that I have never played. We're talking about a topic that I know considerably less about than the median Monster Man listener. But look, I just drive the taxi where people tell me to go. So let's get into the Monsters of Bloodborne, the 2015 action RPG from Software. This is what's called a Souls-like game in that it resembles games in the Dark Souls series, also from the same company. And in it, you play a guy who has to fight monsters in the gloomy streets of a gothic, kind of loosely Eastern European city. And the monsters have attack patterns, and you got to figure out when to dodge, and yada yada. And I guess there's different weapons and things, you know, it's one of those. So like I said, I have not played this game. I don't play a lot of video games, especially new ones. I often kind of return to classics. The most recent game I had been playing some of was Kirby's Adventure. You know, that's the kind of thing we're talking about here. But this game and its relatives have seeped into the popular culture enough, and there's enough material on them out there that I think I can tackle the monsters that Zach sent me, and also Zach very kindly provided some write-ups of the specific monsters that he wanted me to cover, and I've used them to structure this episode. But my knowledge of them is only based on secondhand information. I looked up some videos of them on YouTube, but they were mostly about how to avoid their various attacks, which was less useful for my purposes. So I have constructed a theme out of these monsters, and you can tell me, if you're an enthusiast of the game, whether this is an accurate assessment of the game's theme. But whether it is or isn't, I think it's interesting by itself, because looking at the monsters that Zach has sent me, I think that they at least, you know, maybe not all the monsters in this game, but they at least embody something that games, whether RPG or digital, don't always get right, which is escalating or changing the game's setting or premise. And this kind of escalation is something that can happen a lot in RPGs, largely because so many RPGs, especially kind of classic RPGs, have character advancement as part of their, part of the experience, right? When computer games based on role-playing games began to come out, features that they didn't include included things like role-playing, but features that they did keep included things like character advancement. Most people know what XP stands for now, and it's not because they play D&D. But what's interesting to me is that while character advancement is a significant part of role-playing games, it doesn't happen very much, or doesn't happen that much, in the literature and media that RPGs are derived from. Even when Conan becomes King of Aquilonia, you know, in the story where he's King of Aquilonia, he has like a spooky encounter with a ghost, he has a desperate sword fight against a bunch of assassins in some rooms, I think he's naked. The rooms are in a palace and the assassins hate him because he's the king, and the ghost keeps going on about the fate of nations, but the scope, both tactical and conceptual, is not too different from any other Conan story. And even characters whose power levels substantially vary, like Batman, for instance. Alan Grant used to start all of his Batman or Detective Comics issues, I mean not all, but many, with a kind of like pre-story couple of pages where Batman would catch some jewel thieves or beat up a mugger. And then also you get stories like the Grant Morrison one where we discover that Batman has a flying saucer. And, you know, he takes on Gorilla Grodd head to head. So Batman might fight gods and aliens, but it's not in any kind of progression. He might be in outer space dealing with an alien invasion, or Solaris the Tyrant's Son or something, or he might be traveling around the world trying to find out what's up with the nefarious schemes of Ra's al Ghul, but either way, six issues later, he's going to be back in Gotham City beating up the Ventriloquist and Scarface. So that kind of premise escalation is not super common in the kind of serial media that RPGs are inspired by. There's some. I'm not saying there's none at all. But it is not a significant feature of serial adventure fiction generally, I don't think. Now, we have seen some examples of it in the past on this show, most obviously in our special episode on the Dark Powers of Ravenloft, although that is not really the perspective from which I decided to speak about it. But in that episode, we looked at the idea of revealing that there are a set of supernatural powers behind the supernatural powers of the setting, the gods behind the gods, gods that are best unsung kind of thing that I mentioned in the last episode. A kind of metaphysical escalation that doesn't abandon the previous premise, but provides it with a broader context. And I think that Bloodborne, at least viewed through the prism of its monsters, provides an example of this kind of conceptual escalation. Although, I don't know how much of this you need to care about to play and enjoy the game. I get the impression that you can enjoy the game qua game, with its dodging and its weapons and so forth, without engaging too much with this kind of thinking about its narrative premise. But you tell me. So, Zach sent me a bunch of monsters. I'm going to look at 3 to 4 of them, depending. And I'm going to start with the Blood-Starved Beast, because this boss monster is an example of setting the stakes to begin with. So when the protagonist of Bloodborne arrives in the town of Yharnam, it is the Night of the Hunt, an event in which the city's residents hunt these like werewolf-like monsters. So they're like mobs, there are more professional monster hunters, and these creatures, okay, they're not like traditional werewolves, they're caused by a sort of plague, and my understanding is that we're meant to appreciate the irony of the townsfolk behaving like a pack of hunting animals in this hunt for animal-like monsters. One of these animal-like monsters is the Blood-Starved Beast, which is, well, it's a blood-starved beast, and it lives in an area of the town that was ultimately abandoned because the monsters there got so far out of control. It kind of got walled off or sealed up or something, I don't know. Honestly, I don't find the graphics of Bloodborne very easy to kind of read visually. I find a lot of that type of game murky and mushy, and I don't know, it's just me, something. There's something about them where I look at the thing and I don't form a very clear impression of it. Maybe it's just that it has a bunch of surfaces which all seem to have like a similar level of detailed texture, which I don't think makes things very easy to read. But regardless, it looks like it has a skinny, starved appearance, and its skin is sort of hanging off it in bloody rags, which Zach suggests may reveal that in its thirst for blood, it actually did this to itself, which would, of course, reinforce that theme of the, you know, the irony of hunger, the irony of predation. But so what this does is it sets the stakes, it tells you a little bit about the genre and the premise of this game, but in a way that is perhaps somewhat misleading. Because it's not just this monster, but its whole context with a werewolf hunt and so forth, right? It's an angry mob hunting werewolf-like monsters through the streets of a sort of pseudo-Transylvanian city. It is establishing right at the beginning that we are dealing with gothic horror territory. This is something that could be happening in Ravenloft, although in Ravenloft it would be more, for lack of a better word, square. This has the aesthetics of a 2000s horror film. Ravenloft has the aesthetics of a Hammer horror film, but the principles are the same. We're in a gruesome modern take on the gothic horror aesthetic, the gritty reboot of Ravenloft. And other elements of the game's aesthetics, like the cobblestone streets and whatnot, kind of give us, you know, we're somewhere between Dracula's Transylvania and like Jekyll and Hyde's London. But as the game progresses, we begin to get the understanding that, like, well, maybe there's more going on here. So another monster that Zach sent me, that is the amygdala. Now, I'm sorry to say that this is a terrible name. In general, very few monsters that are named after common words have good names. And this feels very 90s in that respect. I don't know why I think that. Maybe because there is a 90s very minor Batman villain called Amygdala. Or maybe just because that's when I was taking psych in high school in the 90s. This is not a good name because, well, partly because the monster doesn't, I don't think, do any of the things that we would associate with the amygdala. I don't know. Anyway, the point is they are weird extra-dimensional creatures who are just kind of hanging around the city, particularly in the part of it that used to be sort of most inhabited by wizards. And once your character gains a certain level of a stat called insight, which represents a kind of paranormal awareness, you can see them. And the explanation for this seems to be that they have just always been there. There are some other applications of insight that Zach mentions, including an enemy that is powerful if you have the level of insight the game expects you to have at the point that you face it, but which, if you have no insight at all for some reason, is very weak. As an aside, I really like the idea of an increasing insight mechanic rather than something like a depleting sanity mechanic. For a long time, games have pointed out, the most obvious example is Trail of Cthulhu, that sanity in Call of Cthulhu really measures two different things. I mean, it's not a good model of mental health, but also there's the sanity being stressed and fractured by learning more about the true nature of the cosmos, and there's the sanity being stressed and fractured by seeing a bunch of murders and undergoing a bunch of hardship. And those are kind of different things. And I feel that the like accumulating knowledge model rather than the accumulating trauma model, they're slightly different. And I guess that's your Cthulhu mythos skill, I suppose, in Call of Cthulhu. But I like this insight idea. Anyway, the amygdala is primarily a storytelling monster, a monster that exists not so you can fight it, although the wiki seems to suggest that you do sometimes fight it, but to indicate something about the world or setting. A lot of D&D settings that are trying to position themselves as being different from, you know, Greyhawk or the Forgotten Realms have these kinds of not in Kansas anymore monsters. Often monsters that are in some way a rejection or a subversion of an existing fantasy trope, but if they're not that kind of monster, then often they're some kind of Lovecraftian beastie, because that's a way to signal a genre through the inclusion of a monster in the game. So I think that the amygdala is a not in... Is it amygdala? Amygdala? I've always said amygdala. I have no reason to think that's correct. Anyway, I think this is one of those not in Kansas anymore creatures, despite the fact that the setting you're in is hardly Kansas in the first place. And indeed, that is what the presence of monsters like this one signify in this game. Not just a shift between aspects of the setting, but a shift between genres. So if you look at some of the early monsters, it's like a werewolf, a witch, okay, these are classic gothic horror monsters, even if we're seeing this kind of veiny, blood-spattered 21st century take on these gothic tropes. But the amygdala, still a terrible name, is not a gothic horror monster. It is a cosmic horror monster, and its presence, the way that you learn about it, is explicitly set up to reveal that this is not a transition, it's a revelation. This isn't a gothic horror story that's turned into a cosmic horror story. It has been a cosmic horror story all along, and you just haven't realized it, which is the essence of cosmic horror. I once read an article, perhaps it was by Sandy Peterson, in which the author was talking about the different types of horror and said that the kind of ideal horror for Call of Cthulhu was this sort of revolutionary or revelatory horror where the monster, the evil, is not an intrusion into the world, but is the reveal of what the real world is like. The world where things made sense and effect followed cause and so forth. That's the illusion. That's the pretend thing you made up to make yourself feel better. Speaking of cosmic horror, another boss monster that Zach added to the list is Rom the Vacuous Spider, which is a horrid name, but a good one. You know what I mean? I don't know about Rom because it makes me think of Rom Space Knight, but I accept that that's me being weird. So throughout the game, again, is my understanding, my secondhand understanding, you learn more about the Great Ones, which are sort of this game's analog of Lovecraft's Great Old Ones. And at one point in the history of the city, there were this like college of occultists who, at least for some of them, their goal was to become a Great One. And Zach describes Rom as the most successful attempt to turn a human being into a Great One. But the problem is that this most successful attempt, like maybe it was successful in its goal, but it seems to reveal that the goal is maybe not a very good idea, because Rom is horrid. And Rom has a lot of visual signifiers of kind of like being diseased or being unwell, not of being like powerful or threatening. Like Rom has a huge body, but itty bitty little legs. Rom looks grotesque and even in pain, eyes staring wildly through the holes in this kind of stony covering that covers its head. Like a lot of my favorite monsters, you don't want Rom to get you, but you also don't want to end up like Rom. That seems like it would be pretty bad. Now, this to me was the most rip-offable idea for a straight fantasy campaign. Even if you're not trying to run a kind of Bloodborne-like RPG. I think that this idea is really stealable, and it's very expandable. So the idea of having a bunch of weird monsters created by a bunch of wizards who were trying to turn themselves into gods. Each one could be different from the others because all the different techniques, and of course, though it was a disaster each time, they would keep trying, because people with well-developed senses of self-preservation don't try to become gods in the first place, and they could wind up being monsters either because, you know, they abandoned their humanity, or because the cosmos decided to punish them for their hubris, depending on the kind of game you're playing. You know, it works at a traditional level, right? People who challenge the authority of the gods getting turned into monsters is a pretty consistent theme in Greek mythology, for example. That would be a good theme for dungeon bosses, right? If the dungeon was once the, like, magical college of these wizards, so it's full of priceless tomes and artifacts, which is why people are always trying to, like, sneak in and get them, but then they get got by these people that wanted to become immortal or wanted to become gods or whatever, and wind up turning themselves into monsters. You could throw in that Vampire the Masquerade thing about the wizards who wanted to become immortal but wind up just becoming vampires. You know, if the dungeon was once their college, they could have sort of split it up into their own different domains and be competing for leadership or resources. They could even have acolytes, right? You could be the most grotesque failure of a god, and there would still be people who would come to worship you, or at least pretend to worship you until they could find out your secrets. So you could have, you know, three or four grotesque failed gods, each with their own weird cults feuding over the different parts of this ruined wizard college. Sounds like a pretty good dungeon. I'd play that. And I want to stress this again. I have not played this game. I've just looked at pictures of the monsters online, read the wiki entry, read Zach's descriptions of them, and so on. But you know what? From that process, like, for my purposes, it doesn't really matter if my interpretation of the game is correct, since what I am trying to do is come up with fun things to do with monsters, not accurately simulate Bloodborne in a role-playing game. I'm not trying to have a map of Yharnam and all the different types of monsters, give them stats, whatever. I'm trying to be inspired by this thing to have fun themes and create fun monsters. So even if my interpretation of these is not correct in terms of representing the monsters that appears in the game, I think there's some fun to be had with these ideas, and I think that that's what's really important. So obviously we've got the idea of people trying to become gods and winding up as, you know, monstrous beings that don't have the sense to just fade away, but don't have the power to go up to heaven. But I also like the idea of starting out with some variation of a gothic horror monster, a monster that in outline the players would expect to see. Also, that idea that people decide to hunt a monster with monstrous behavior, which in turn might implicate them, you know, as potential monsters themselves. It doesn't have to be gothic horror. I know that this idea partly works because gothic horror and cosmic horror overlap significantly to begin with. The podcast Voluminous, which is about the letters of H.P. Lovecraft, used to characterize Lovecraft's writing as gothic horror, which I think that's probably not true, but it's not a completely unreasonable thing to say. I mean, I think that that's the insight behind Knight's Black Agents, like, oh, you thought this was a spy story, but it's a vampire story, because in fact, the kind of secrecy and conspiracy of those genres overlaps significantly. So I do think that you have to be very cautious about them. I always use Batman as my example, because I was obsessed with Batman as a kind of early teenager. And there is a pretty successful Batman gothic story, successful in terms of atmosphere. The actual story makes no sense at all, by Grant Morrison. It is called Gothic, although it was collected under the title Whispers, I think. And it works that way because Batman has some of those spooky gothic elements. And even then, you could have told that story without Batman and it would have been perfectly fine. It could have been anybody. There's like one bit where he does some superheroing. Mostly just a ghost story. But that's because those overlap to some extent anyway. So you want to choose genres to shift between that have some shared whatever, right? And that can often mean something like going from epic fantasy to gritty fantasy, or going from like cozy bucolic fantasy to epic fantasy. I mean, arguably that's kind of the transition from The Hobbit to The Lord of the Rings or whatever. I also like the idea of monsters that are just hanging out observing things and that you can't see until you're sufficiently informed or sufficiently corrupted. Again, this kind of trades on what your assumptions are about monsters to begin with. So the fact that creatures so strange apparently think that is important to keep an eye on this situation is a great way of suggesting that something is very wrong, because these don't seem like the kind of creatures that observe everyday activities. A lot of these monsters have some of that quality of the tragic grotesque. I've been thinking about this, you know. I always say I like a tragic grotesque. I'm not sure I do in my games. I think I often don't put the kind of grisly content in my games. I have in the past, but I feel like it's an aesthetic that I'm moving away from. And I think it's harder to do in role-playing games than it is in primarily visual media, like a video game, where you can just have Rom's appearance or the blood-starved beast's appearance kind of speak for itself. I guess you can do that with miniatures, like the toe tickler, as I mentioned. But yeah, I think there's something there in terms of shifting genre expectations and using monsters as a way to present that changing theme. Could be something. And even if it's not, I'm putting a pin in dungeon full of people who attempted to become gods in some grand ritual and wound up just becoming monsters. I think there's definitely something to that. All right, so that's about all the time I have to talk about a video game that I have absolutely never played for today. Zach, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Everyone else, remember that if you'd like to be like Zach and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we're taking a little bit of a break from the specials, and we're going to talk about a book that's just come in over the transom. And in the special after that, we're going to be taking a look at the monsters of a folk song from the 70s. So I hope that you will join me then, right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram at MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, GonzoHistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.